We have come in our studies to Romans chapter 9, verse 20 and 21, and we're going to be looking this evening at this comment or contradiction that Paul made. In verse 19, he anticipates that there are going to be some reading his material that will argue with him about this whole issue of God showing mercy and hardening. And he says, "You will say to me then, why does he still find fault for who resists his will?" We looked at that as the introduction to this study of this paragraph, and we tackled Paul's willingness to go straight to the heart of the issue as far as the objectors to truth go, and that is the issue of God having an irresistible will and a simultaneous commitment to visit judgment on those who pursue evil. In the objector's mind, God should give all evil creatures a pass, since their existence as evil creatures is an integral part of his irresistible will. And if, they say, evil is a part of the plan, and no man can resist the plan, God has no business finding fault with those who are simply going along with the plan. And in that study, we put forward a primary observation, and that observation was that it's hypocritical for men to find fault with God while claiming he has no business finding fault with them. So in this evening study, we're going to look a little bit further into this hypocrisy in verses 20 and 21. My translation says, "On the contrary, who are you, O man, who answers back to God? The thing molded will not say to the molder, why did you make me like this, will it? Or doesn't the potter have a right over the clay to make from the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common use?" Paul is actually responding in verses 20 and 21 to the person who finds fault with God for finding fault with people who can't or don't, well, can't operate contrary to his irresistible will. And so what we find in verse 20 and 21 is Paul's reaction. And if you could read this in the language as he wrote it, I think the first thing that we can say is that Paul's reaction is one of horror. The opening words of Romans 9:20 are literally, "O man, no." The "O man" part of the opening is evocative, and he is directly addressing the man who says, why does he still find fault for who resists his will? And Paul's response is, "Oh man, you," the person who's saying that very thing. And the word that's translated "on the contrary" in the New American Standard is, in the King James, "Nay, but, oh man, who are you?" And the interesting thing about that word, it's only found about four times in the New Testament. It's menunga, or something like that. And it's three times of the four, the translators of the King James say yes instead of no. If you want to look at them, they're Luke 11:28, Romans 10:18, which is just another chapter a little further on, and Philippians 3:8. But the word is rare enough that I had to go back to some of the other resources to find out what's really going on here. Because it really isn't nigh, which is yes, and it's not ooh, which is no, or may, which is no. It's not even connected to those words. And so one of the things I found out by going back to some of those other sources is that part of the reason for the translation yes, 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 and then no in that kind of setting is that it doesn't really mean yes or no in and of itself. It's called an emphatic particle that posits either an emphasis upon a positive, yay, or an emphatic correction of a negative, which would be no. So it doesn't mean yes or no by itself. The context determines whether it's emphatically positive or emphatically contrary as a correction to something that's wrong. And so that's the reason why the translators varied on their translation, because they were looking at the context to see whether the speaker was being emphatic in a positive, reinforcing kind of way, or whether he was being negative in a contradictory kind of, no, you're dead wrong here kind of way. And so the essential issue is that the word is used in that kind of emphatic setting. And the second part of the reason that the translators went with yes three out of the four times is that the part of the translator's job is to reflect the actual meaning of the idea when you're moving it from one language into another. And that's often means that you can't go with a literal word-for-word translation per se, because if you do that slavishly literal, you'll end up misunderstanding colloquial statements and idiomatic expressions that are found in one language that don't easily go into the other. So that's the reason why you have this variation translation. But the fact is, it is an emphatic issue, and in this context, it's an emphatic contradiction. It's, oh man, no! Because the idea that has been set forth in verse 19 is the idea that a creature has some kind of right to find fault with God, while disallowing him to find fault with creatures. The phrase reflects a rather profound level of horrified opposition to that inherent hypocrisy. The very notion that an ignorant creature, and by ignorant I don't mean that as a derogatory term, it's a fact. If you're not omniscient, you're ignorant. And it doesn't really matter how much you know. If you're not omniscient, there's a whole bunch of other stuff you don't know. And that puts you at the disadvantage in relation to making any kind of critical comment about somebody who is omniscient. So at any point where an ignorant creature sets himself up to render a charge of ungodliness against an omniscient God, the underlying issue there is a towering arrogance on the part of the ignorant, where he thinks he knows more than he does. And he's not bashful about declaring something to be true that is absolutely ludicrous for a creature to posit. That's just like all of these atheists that the scriptures are not bashful about just calling fools. The fool has said in his heart no to the idea of God or no to God personally. It's foolish because the whole notion that you can declare that there is no God assumes that you know everything there is to know, and God isn't a part of the knowledge. And that assumption is something that is only fed by people who think they're smarter than they are. And they think that their education and background gives them the right to make these pontifical assertions of some really crazy notions. So, ignorant creatures are in very dangerous waters when they start contradicting something about God who has expressed himself in the words of language that they can understand. And then, at any point where an immoral creature, rather than an ignorant one, an immoral creature sets him or herself up to render a charge of immorality against the only wise God, the underlying issue is, again, a towering arrogance where you absolutely refuse to recognize the hypocrisy in your charge against God as one of the creatures of God at the moral level. Because we've argued already multiple times that Romans chapter 9 starts off with the basic bottom line of moral behavior is a self-sacrificing love even for those who hate you and want to destroy you. That's the bottom line. And God has demonstrated the reality of his commitment to the bottom line at Calvary so that his sacrifice of himself in relation to the offer of his son as a sacrifice for sin, it was a sacrifice of himself, it was a sacrifice of his son, it was a sacrifice of the Spirit, it was a sacrifice of the triune God in order to bring us into the possibility of forgiveness and redemption and all of those good things. But the sacrifice was profound because it was infinite. And it's infinite in time, which is eternity, as well as in degree. Christ's death for sin was of such an infinite degree that it wouldn't have mattered if there were 20 billion people who had each done 20 billion sins themselves personally. The death that Christ died would have over paid for all of that, because you have this price paid by the infinite God. So, any creature who isn't willing to be self-sacrificing to that degree has no business challenging the moral integrity of God, who's already demonstrated his willingness. And as I said in earlier study, it's no accident that the Bible only records two men who actually come even close to the idea of this kind of love, Moses and Paul. I mean, they're the only ones that ever claimed that they'd be willing to perish for the sake of their enemies. And the perishing was in view of eternity. It's no accident that men don't come to that kind of love. They never come to it on their own, and they seldom come to it even while empowered by and directed by the Spirit of God. The sanctification that we require to get to that point is massive. Now, when we see him, we will be like him in moral character. At that point, we'll have the kind of love we need to have. But anybody who would challenge the moral integrity of God while themselves being fully committed to their own self-centered agendas has absolutely nothing to say. That's why every mouth will be shut, every knee will bow when God finally addresses these issues of human beings judging him. So, in terms of an emphatic rejection of this argument, I think Paul's horrified. He said, oh man, no! You can't go there! And then, having said that much, he confronts it, because he challenges this arrogant creature with what the translators render, who are you? But I think we have an expression in our particular generation and setting that is more to the point, and that is, who do you think you are? It's not who are you, it's who do you think you are? And that's what Paul is actually saying in verse 20. Oh man, no, who do you think you are? Good question. Anybody that would set himself in opposition to God and try to present the idea that he has a rational right and a moral right to do it, it's just... So, he goes from asking the question, who do you think you are, to a couple of descriptive things that tell him who he is. The first thing that he says about this person who thinks he's more than he is, you who are answering back to God. You are answering back to God. Who do you think you are? And this replies against God, as the King James says. This word is only found in this text and in Luke 14:6. And the other text is clear, because in Luke 14, the opposition is approaching Jesus with an issue, and he just flat shuts them down, because he walks into a setting where there's a man who needs healing, physical healing, and opposition is there for only one reason, to try to trap him for doing this good thing on the Sabbath. So before he does anything, he just asks them, is it... a bad thing for a person to do good on the Sabbath? And then he says this. He says, which one of you, having an ox that falls into the ditch on the Sabbath, would wait until the next day to get it out? He didn't say it that way. He said, which of you, having an ox fall in the ditch, won't immediately help it out, even if it's on the Sabbath? And he knows, and they know, the answer to that. Every one of them, when it comes to self-serving action, will take that action even on the Sabbath if their pocketbook or some part of their livelihood is at risk. And they know it. They know they do that. And he knows they know they do that. And they know he knows. So, having all these people fully aware, he has shut them down. They have absolutely nothing to reply. That's our word to him. So when he describes them, this individual, as the one who replies back or answers back to God, he's describing somebody whose hypocrisy is hidden to him until somebody says something that just pulls the scales off and they can see it. So what Paul is accusing them of doing in his horrified, oh man, no, is they're trying to make God out to be a hypocrite for having an irresistible will and yet finding fault with sinners. They're trying to make God look bad with those two real characteristics. They're suggesting that this is not right. But it's fact of history and reality. And it's rooted in the creation work of an omniscient, omnipotent God whose moral character has been established in history at Calvary. So that, let me say it this way, even if God was the devil in terms of moral character, but he had created creatures, those creatures would have an inherent obligation to be loyal to their creator, regardless of his moral characteristics. There's no such thing as a creature who can morally rebel against his creator for any perceived reason. But God is not the devil. And God's absolute moral superiority was demonstrated at Calvary in his love for his enemies to the point that infinity died in order to give them an opportunity or an option of life. And having that established in history, it makes it absolutely indisputable that God can't possibly be called a hypocrite at the moral level, in spite of the fact that, yes, he does have an irresistible will, and yes, he still is righteous and will judge sinners when it comes time for judgment. So, he's addressing their total blindness in their hypocrisy. And then he says, not only are you resisting God, not only are you answering back to him, but you are the thing molded. And you're saying to the molder, why'd you make me like this? So he's talking about a thing formed, talking back to or complaining about the former, the thing formed and the former, the one who forms it. The former is the creator. The thing formed is the creature. You can't have any, there is no moral justification for the creature to complain to the creator about anything the creator has done. There's no moral basis for it. So that if a person tries to do that, they're proving their own immorality and therefore bringing themselves under the justice and right judgment of God. So, thing formed is a translation of a word that is actually translated in or transliterated into our language. It's the word plasma. Now, it doesn't mean plasma in the sense that we mean it according to the dictionary. But the idea of the plasma is found, the word's used twice, in the verb form, in 1 Timothy 2:13, he's arguing that God first formed Adam and then Eve. And he's establishing the headship of Adam over the race and of Adam's culpability before God because Eve was deceived but Adam wasn't. And he said Adam was first formed. That's the verb form of this plasma thing. And the basic issue or the basic illustration of the plasma form thing is that you have this like liquid molten metal being poured into a form that once it cools, it will have taken on the form of the thing that it was poured into. You could use liquid wax if you wanted to, pouring it into a mold, and then there it is. So the thing that is being molded can't complain to the mold, why did you make me like this? I was just poured into your mold. Why? Why? What level of whatever integrity or right or whatever you have to do this to me? And he's saying, the thing molded will not say to the molder, why did you make me like this, will it? Well, yeah, it will. If it is saying something to the effect that, hey, God's will is irresistible, I'm just doing whatever his irresistible will in decrees, and therefore he shouldn't find fault with it. So he's actually saying that the person who accuses God of hypocrisy in having a will and judging the wicked, he's challenging the right of the one who forms to make the questioner as he has made him. And then that brings an illustration right out of his own setting. In verse 20, he says, doesn't the potter have a right over the clay to make of the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common or dishonorable? The idea here is every potter on the planet reserves the right to take a lump of clay and cut it into a couple pieces and make out of one part of it a vessel that is going to be looked at and oohed and awed over, and it's a glorious kind of thing. And to take the other half of the same lump and turn it into a spittoon or something that is useful only because of the necessity of the case, and it's a despicable thing. It's not oohed and awed over. It's just something that's serviceable for some of the bad habits of human beings or whatever. He says, give me an honest potter anywhere on the planet that says, oh, you don't have the right to do that. I don't have the right to do that. You can't find one. Everybody knows that the potter can take the clay and make anything out of it he wants to. Now, there is an issue here that I think that we need to do some thinking about, and that is the issue of the difference between human beings and clay. It's not a big deal to make a spittoon out of a piece of clay. The clay has no sensibility. It's not going to be injured in any sense by somebody spitting their spit into it. Clay's clay. It's inanimate, insensate. There's nothing there. It seems to me that Paul is equating Adam as having been made out of clay, because he was, and then restricting Adam to being just a feature or a figure made out of clay. Because that's really not the heart of the issue here. The heart of the issue is human beings are significantly different than clay in the sense that the things that can happen to human beings have a direct impact on them in terms of either joy or grief or pleasure or pain or admiration or humiliation. Those are characteristics that only personal creatures, sensible creatures, can experience. And because they can experience them, it's a far different cry. You can take a piece of clay and jab it with a sharp object, and the clay has no, it doesn't hurt, doesn't bother it. But you can't do that to a human being. It hurts! I mean, you can do it, but the consequences are seriously differentiated. So one of the things what we have to keep in mind is that Paul, even though he's arguing that the potter has the right over the clay, and fundamentally God was the potter and Adam was the clay. He made him out of the clay of the ground. That's where he got him. He got him out of the clay of the ground. And then he breathed his spirit of life into him and created by that a sensate creature, a creature of sensibilities that can feel and hurt and rejoice and all of those things. Because what we're really dealing with here in the idea of God judging sinners is that the judgment's described all over the scriptures as a horrifying and never-ending eternal thing. The whole concept of eternal judgment is so awesome in its reach that most of us simply don't think about it. It's too horrifying to consider. The idea that a person would be consigned to the problem of fire for the body and tears for the soul and grinding of the teeth for the spirit without remedy for all of the rest of existence, infinity of existence, forever. That is such an awesome thing that most of us simply don't even want to go there. And quite frankly, the fact that we don't want to go there is the reason why we don't love like God loves. Because Paul said, I'd be willing to do that for these people who hate me, that are my kinsmen according to the flesh. Moses said to God, if you're not going to forgive their sin, then blot me out of the book in their place. This voluntary commitment to this horrible scenario of disaster forever is just beyond most of us, simply because of one thing. We're too self-centered. Deal with it. We don't want to have to deal with that. But one of the realities of the God who made us is His infinity of all of His attributes, which include justice and wrath and condemnation for those who resist and do evil to others. And I think that if we aren't careful, we will actually diminish the sacrifice that Jesus made on Calvary by mitigating the reality of this condemnation or judgment that's coming. So to the degree that Christ fulfilled the actual fulfillment of the demands of justice for sin against infinity, to the degree that we embrace that, to that degree we're horrified by the notion that somebody might have to be subject to that. But Jesus was. So, I think we need to keep that in mind when he argues that the potter has the right over the clay, because the potter does have the right over the clay. And in verses 22 and following, when we finally do get there, next week perhaps, the issue is more than just the potter and the clay. But before we go there, the last thing I really want to inject into this is what I just call an observation from verses 20 and 21. And that observation is this. According to verse 19, the arrogant creature has set himself up as a judge of God. And that in itself is an attempt to put God under himself. You can't judge God without exalting yourself over him. You can't accuse him of something immoral without exalting yourself as a superior moral being in your criticism of this God. Well, that is the Lucifer issue at the beginning of sin in the creation of God. Lucifer said, I'm going to exalt myself over God. I'm going to set my throne above the throne of God. I'm going to be the God, and I'll decide what happens to the one who claims he's God now. That's the whole issue. I'm going to criticize and blame this one, and by doing so, I'm setting myself above him. Well, as soon as you do that, you discover that Jesus' words in Luke 19 fit. So I'd like for you just to think a little bit about what's going on in Luke 19, because Jesus is telling a story there that addresses our thinking here in Romans 9. In Luke 19, there's a discussion here that's starts actually in verse 11, goes down through verse 27. But he's telling a parable because he's near Jerusalem and they suppose that the kingdom of God is to appear immediately. And he says, verse 12, certain noblemen went to a distant country to receive a kingdom for himself and then return. And he called 10 of his slaves and he gave them 10 minas and he said to them, do business with this until I come back. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we don't want this man to reign over us. And it came about that when he returned after receiving the kingdom, he ordered that these slaves to whom he had given the money be called to him in order that he might know what business they had done. And the first appeared saying, Master, your mina has made 10 minas more. And he said to him, well done, good slave, because you've been faithful in a very little thing. Be in authority over 10 cities. And the second came saying, your mina, master, has made 5 minas. And he said to him also, and you are to be over 5 cities. And another one came saying, Master, Behold your mina, which I put away in a handkerchief. For I was afraid of you, because you're an exacting or austere or, by implication, an unfair, rigid man. You take up what you didn't lay down, and you reap what you didn't sow. And he said to him, and here's the issue, by your own words I will judge you, you worthless slave. Did you know that I'm an exacting man, too rigid, too unfair, taking up what I didn't lie down and reaping where I didn't sow? Then why didn't you put the money in the bank, and having come, I would have collected it with interest? And he said to the bystanders, take the mina away from him and give it to the one who has the 10. And they said, Master, he has 10 already. I tell you that everyone who has more shall be given, but the one who doesn't have, even what he has shall be taken away. But these enemies of mine who didn't want me to reign over them, bring them here and slay them in my presence. Now the significant thing about this is that there is a serious warning to anybody who decides they're going to criticize God. And that warning is this: I will judge you by the words that come out of your own mouth. You have decided that I am like this, and therefore I'm going to tell you what you should have done, since you believe that I was like this. And the fact that you should have done and didn't do it opens you up to judgment. And that's the issue. The arrogance of criticizing God as a creature is along the lines of the Luke 19 story, and the austere man doesn't even bother to contradict the claim. He didn't say, oh, you got me all wrong. I'm not like that. He didn't say that. He just said, I'll just push it to your logical conclusion in terms of what you're complaining about. You knew I was like this, so you should have done this. And that's the way God is as judge. He is the judge, but he's also the God of Calvary. And he is simply subjecting the objector to what he has subjected himself. You want to be God? Then don't complain about your desire that has led you to the same suffering that God produced for himself. You want to be God? That means you're going to be the one who suffers the Calvary thing. That's what I've suffered as God. You want to be superior to me? Then you're going to have to be subject to the same thing. So he subjects him to it. The problem is he isn't God. And that's the disaster for the creature who would be God in his place. He is actually subjected to the very thing that God didn't hesitate to subject himself to. And yet that's where all the screeching comes from. I don't want to be subjected to this. Well, then don't complain against God, because he subjected himself to it. And that means if you want to put yourself above him morally, then you're going to have to be subject to it too. So I really think that what's going on in Romans 9 is that Paul is pulling absolutely no punches. He recognizes the horror of the creature whose arrogance is so bad that he can't even see his hypocrisy in complaining against God. And because he can't see it, he's going to be subject to it. It's going to get more clear as we go further into the text in terms of what God's actually doing here. Because the bottom line is, the issue is his irresistible will and his freedom to judge sinners in the context of that. And part of the issue in verses 22 and following is an explanation for what God's actually doing. But we'll get to that, Lord willing.